This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the campaigns to curtail and reverse rights for gay and transgendered people across the United States. And first, what was the experience of gay people in East and West Germany during the Cold War? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. LGBTQI plus issues are at the forefront of human rights discourses internationally. Even more so than in the United States, European states have sought to advance gender equality and protections of queer culture in their own countries as well as abroad. On today's show, we will explore queer culture, queer politics, and gender equality campaigns in Germany with a particular historical approach. Our guest today is Samuel Clues Hünecke. He is assistant professor of history at George Mason University. He's the author of Heterogeneous Persecution, Lesbianism, and the Nazi State. But perhaps more importantly for today's show, he's written a new book on this topic, States of Liberation, Gay Men Between Dictatorship and Democracy in Cold War Germany. It places gay liberation in historic context, and in particular examines the different experiences of gay culture in both East and West Germany during the Cold War. Samuel, thank you very much for joining us. First, when we think of queer culture in Germany, this is an area that certainly pop culture, you know, has addressed pretty well. I think of plays like Cabaret, for example, in those descriptions. How accurate are some of these descriptions?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And you're right. I think, you know, the Weimar era, so the roaring 20s in Germany is this iconic moment. It's iconic culturally because a lot of what we associate with modern culture really comes out of this moment. There are all sorts of famous movies, Bauhaus architecture, modernist art, so on and so forth. And one of those sort of elements is the flourishing of a queer subculture. So you have gay and lesbian and trans nightclubs, publications, rights movements, and it's this really remarkable decade in Germany. And so it has been sort of, you know, it's made its way into our culture. I think obviously of Cabaret, as you mentioned, Babylon Berlin, the TV show, has a lot of this in it. There's also the series that I'm now forgetting the name of, but the sort of trans series that came out a few years ago has a season that deals with Weimar Berlin, and so on and so forth. And I think actually remarkably, a lot of it is sort of correct or gets it right. I think there's you know, if anything, there might be a tendency to make it a little too glossy or a little bit too sort of sparkly. I think one thing that's easy to forget is that it was still a period when there was ongoing persecution. So even in this moment of sort of queer exuberance, you still have male homosexuality criminalized under paragraph 175 of Germany's criminal code. You still have a great deal of taboo, discrimination, other forms of persecution. Queer people are still oftentimes blackmailed. So, you know, I think that's maybe where a bit more nuance can help. But it's, you know, I actually think a lot of these TV shows and movies and musicals and so on do get some of that nuance. They show, you know, because oftentimes they have the Nazi period in the sort of, you know, as what's coming. And, you know, when you're watching these things, you have a sense that the Nazis are coming. And so in order to make that realistic or to make that sort of what's in the audience's mind, there is that ambiguity of the Weimar period. There's that acknowledgement that there are these reactionary forces that are just sort of waiting to destroy German democracy.
And this is kind of one of the themes, you know, of the book and themes, I think, generally of queer culture, is that you've got this thriving culture and then this political reaction. And certainly when you think of Weimar and when you think of the cultural reaction that that was represented in the Nazi Party. So how much was the rise of Nazism, at least in part, a kind of culture war reaction to some of this?
That's something that historians still really debate. It's sort of an open question among historians who study this. And actually, there's a really fabulous other book in the same series at the University of Toronto Press by a historian named Laurie Marhoefer that actually tackles this exact question. And what Laurie finds, or what they argue, is that there isn't actually sort of, they argue against the common perception that it wasn't this sort of reaction, or at least that that reaction didn't help. I think from my perspective, I don't focus so much in my research on the Weimar period itself. It's sort of an important precursor to the periods that I focus on. And so for to my mind, what's really important is that even if that reaction isn't what propelled the Nazis to power, the Nazis' experience of sort of sexual modernity in Weimar was an incredibly important catalyst for how they defined their own views, right? These fascists, Hitler, Goebbels, Himmler, all of them, they really saw the queerness of Weimar as a symptom of what they saw as the decadence of the Weimar democracy. They saw it as a problem, they saw it as a weakness, they saw it as something that had to be sort of rooted out and destroyed. And so that very much informs the persecution of queer people in the 1930s and 1940s under Nazi Germany, even if it's not something that necessarily sort of is why the Nazi Party came to power.
And they certainly, by the way, used persecution of queer communities. I think of the role of queerness and accusations of, you know, violations of those laws, even in, you know, the takedown of the SA leader, Ernst Röhm, and the so-called Night of the Long Knives. Yeah.
No, exactly. They're very cynical about their use of sort of homophobia and these sort of, you know, fear of gender and sexual non-normativity. And so Ernst Röhm, as you know, it was one of Hitler's sort of closest friends and confidants, was sort of more or less openly gay man. And a year into Nazi rule, he's murdered on Hitler's orders, and his homosexuality is sort of used as a pretense for that. It's basically an internal party purge that gets sort of catalyzed for other reasons, but then homosexuality is this very convenient excuse. They also use it to get rid of various sort of enemies in the Catholic Church and in the military. So there is both a sort of cynical element to its use, but then there's also a genuine fear of, in particular, sort of homoeroticism and homosociality in these all-male spaces. I mean, I think that's one thing that we actually talk about quite a bit, is that the imagery, the iconography of the Nazi period is incredibly homoerotic, right? And you have these all-male organizations and this sort of sense of brotherhood, of male camaraderie, and that lends itself very easily to a sort of homoerotic or homosexual imagination or fear in the case of people like Heinrich Himmler, who was an incredibly homophobic individual. And so there is this real fear that in the ranks of the SS or the SA or the military, homosexuality is somehow spreading or undermining Nazism.
No, absolutely. We started this conversation focusing on Nazi Germany, but your book actually is not really about Nazi Germany. It's much more about the Cold War. The expectation when I started reading this, I sort of assumed that West Germany as a democratic state would have been much more open to LGBTQ rights, and East Germany as a communist state would have been much more hostile. Is that the record?
So short answer is no, that's not the record, right? And that is exactly the assumption that I went into this research with. So I started researching this book about 7 years ago, and I had the exact same sort of model in mind, right? That Western capitalist democratic states are generally friendlier to sexual minorities, and dictatorships, communist states, are generally less friendly. And in the case of East and West Germany, it's a much more complex story. And so even right at the end of World War II and the onset of the Cold War, these two states start to diverge. In 1935, Nazi Germany introduced a much harsher version of paragraph 175, this law that criminalized male homosexuality. And East West Germany in 1949, when these two states come into being, they get to determine what to do with this law. And quite surprisingly, West Germany decides to keep the Nazi law. And as a result, they convict over 50,000 men between 1949 and 1969. I mean, this is a massive number of convictions, and that does not account for all the other ways that gay men were persecuted. I have some cases that I talk about in the book of gay men in West Germany who were sent to sanatoria, to mental health institutions, in some cases for a quarter of a century, where, you know, the doctors there tried to quote unquote cure them of their homosexuality. So it's an incredibly bleak place in the 50s and 60s for gay men in particular, as well as other queer individuals. In East Germany, you have this sort of counterintuitive development where the courts very early on vacate the Nazi law and they revert to the earlier version of this law, paragraph 175, and that makes it much harder to get convictions. And so many, many fewer men are convicted, both in absolute terms and per capita in East Germany than in West Germany. By the late 1950s, early 1960s, there are other changes to the law that make it very difficult to prosecute victimless crimes. And so by that point, basically, the East Germans have stopped to prosecute, you know, adult consensual acts between men. And so in some ways, at least from a legal perspective, East Germany is actually quite a bit better than West Germany. It's quite a bit more progressive. In terms of the ramifications for everyday life, there's a lot of similarities. You know, there's still a huge amount of taboo, of sort of social opprobrium. It's not like being homosexual is somehow accepted all of a sudden in either state. And so gay men are oftentimes forced to seek out sexual partners in public places, you know, cruising locations. So they'll go to public parks or toilets, public baths, and look for sexual partners there. There are also bars in the larger cities of both countries that sort of get reputations for being friendly to gay men or to other queer people. But again, these are not like sort of the gay clubs of today. These are very surreptitious locales. They're often subject to police raids. This is not sort of a happy time. Around and I found various glimpses of this world of sort of house parties in the 50s and 60s that they would host. So it's, but again, short answer, basically East Germany, it's not strictly better than West Germany, but it's a much more complex story than the sort of Cold War mindset would suggest.
Kind of digging in first into the West Germany case, my impression of West German, you know, politics and history was that so much of the post-war period, especially the immediate post-war period with the rise of the Christian Democrats, was an attempt on the part, you know, people like Konrad Adenauer to position West Germany as a conservative state that wasn't a Nazi state. And so how much was that maintaining a certain cultural conservatism, but attempting to walk the line to say, yes, I'm right wing, but I'm not Nazi right wing. And then right. And how does this fit into all of that?
I mean, that's such a good point. So basically after the war, you have basically three major parties in West Germany. You have the Christian Democratic Union, the Social Democratic Party, and then the Free Democratic Party. And the Free Democratic Party is sort of this centrist party that is sort of the fulcrum between the two big parties, which are the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. And the Christian Democrats are basically West Germany's party of government. They are, with the exception of 12 years in the middle of the Cold War, they are the ones in charge of the country. And under Konrad Adenauer, who's West Germany's first chancellor, as you say, he's sort of inventing a kind of conservatism that is also anti-Nazi. At the same time, though, he is making a play for former Nazi voters. So, you know, he introduces all these amnesty laws to basically say, okay, if you committed a crime during the war years, you know, unless it was a really serious crime, it's sort of forgotten and forgiven and we're moving on. A lot of former Nazis are able to reclaim their jobs in the government or their pensions. You have what some contemporaries call a re-Nazification of the judiciary. So a lot of former Nazi judges get their jobs back, former Nazi prosecutors. And so that plays a big role when it comes to prosecuting paragraph 175 and prosecuting all these men. There's actually in the early 1950s, a mass roundup of gay men in Frankfurt am Main, which is one of the large cities in West Germany. So you have, it's sort of curious, and this is one thing that I sort of delve into, you have both an effort to distance the party and the state from Nazism, but also a lot of continuities with the Nazi period. And I think conservatives in this period, they do sort of two things when it comes to homosexuality and other moral issues. So they tend to cast the Nazis as having actually been more sort of permissive when it came to sexual issues or gender issues. So, and it's not, this isn't complete fabrication, right? There are there were elements within the Nazi party who wanted to do away with traditional marriage, for instance, and focus on, you know, the question of childbearing, right? For them, having more children was much more important than preserving the sort of sanctity of marriage. So there's that element where Adenauer and the CDU, they're sort of trying to restore normality by restoring these traditional values. At the same time, there's this myth that is still in currency today of the sort of gay Nazi. And this goes back to Ernst Röhm, this, right? And so there's this myth that somehow fascists are all gay. It also has to do, as we talked about, with the sort of homoerotic iconography of fascism. And so that's also something that gets brought up, this notion that, you know, we're rejecting homosexuality because it has some sort of inherent link to fascism. At the same time, you'll see these same commentators saying things like, oh, it's too bad that we can't deal with them as harshly as we did 10 years ago. So it's there's sort of a, it doesn't quite occupy a coherent place in the West German imagination in the 50s and 60s. And basically what I argue and what I found in the book is that it is in this very tense relationship with West Germany's negotiation with the Nazi past. And it has this element of continuity with the Nazi past, and it's a symptom of the country's anxiety about its ability to get over that past.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the different experiences of gay culture in East and West Germany with Samuel Klose Hünecke, author of States of Liberation, Gay Men Between Dictatorship and Democracy in Cold War Germany. So we've been discussing West Germany. How much does that change when the Social Democrats then will eventually win power? How much are gay rights a part of the Social Democrats' identity and campaigns?
So that's, you know, that's another thing where you would sort of assume, okay, this is sort of the center-left progressive party. Surely they would be in favor of gay rights. And up to a point, that's true. So they first enter government in the mid-1960s in a so-called grand coalition with the CDU. So it's both the center-right and the center-left parties together. Crucially, a social democrat takes over the Ministry of Justice, which is overseeing a reform of the criminal code. And so from that sort of perch, they are able to reform paragraph 175. And in 1969, that's when adult homosexuality is legalized for the first time in West Germany. And this is a major watershed. That's the same year that Willy Brandt, a social democrat, becomes chancellor, and you have 12 years or 13 years of social democratic rule in West Germany. And what's interesting about that decade, the 1970s, is that it, from the perspective of sort of queer activism, it is an incredibly rambunctious, joyous decade. You have all of these gay and lesbian rights movements, quite radical movements that get their start in various university towns and cities across West Germany. They press for all sorts of revolutionary things. And they really do, I think, change the society and the culture. And that's sort of, you know, I have a chapter detailing this incredibly joyful decade. At the same time, though, they don't make very much progress, or really any progress at all, at a sort of high political level. And part of this is that there's an incredible resistance from within the Social Democratic Party to acknowledge gay and lesbian issues and rights. Helmut Schmidt, who is the second SPD chancellor in this era, he actually says, and it might be apocryphal, but it sort of captures his view, I'm not the chancellor of the gays. And so this is, he's being pressed by his coalition partners, the Free Democratic Party. They want to reform paragraph 175. They want to set an equal age of consent for gay sex and straight sex. And Schmidt is very resistant to this. He's sort of a more conservative social democrat. And I think, you know, one of the main reasons for this is that the social democrats, they're this, you know, they're the oldest sort of leftist party on earth. This is a party that, you know, Karl Marx helped to found. And basically, they at this point are very resistant to understanding social issues that don't fall into the frame of class. And so And this is actually a debate that really divides the gay and lesbian movement themselves. You have communists and socialists who are activists, and they see it as a sort of subset of the broader sort of socialist struggle against capitalism. And then you have others who say, no, no, this is an independent struggle, and we shouldn't be subordinating it to sort of other political priorities. So this is sort of very much in the air, and I think that has a lot to do with why the Social Democrats don't sort of wholeheartedly embrace gay and lesbian rights until really the 1990s or early 2000s.
So probably a perfect transition then to talk about East Germany in this case, because again, the Marxist inspiration, the Marxist foundation of the East German state, you described the East Germans as returning back to a pre-Nazi interpretation of the law, but how much advancement of gay rights, you know, does that mean, or is it the law on paper, but in reality, it is still quite a repressed community?
So that's a great question. And, you know, in the 50s and 60s, as I sort of have said, I think there's a lot of similarities in terms of everyday life for queer people in both East and West Germany, that it's still, in both cases, I think it's a repressed community. I think we can speak about persecution and discrimination. In the 1970s, when in West Germany, as I mentioned, you have this activist movement that gets started. Some of those activists travel across the Iron Curtain and they spend time in East Berlin. And they start meeting people there. And in particular, they meet a couple gay men who are incredibly inspired by what they're doing. And for them, it sort of awakens a new way of seeing the world. And I actually interviewed one of these men, Peter Rausch, who's a sort of becomes a leading East German gay rights activist. And he said that that moment of sort of thinking about Western gay liberation efforts, he had never thought about paragraph 175 and the sort of discrimination against homosexuals. He said that he had never thought about it in terms of the state being wrong. He had always just assumed that he was wrong. And so it's this eye-opening moment, and these men start to organize. They start to organize house parties, but with a sort of explicit political tinge, right? Their goal is to change things and to make life better for themselves. And eventually they swell in size. Lesbians start to join their group. And eventually, in a very sort of serendipitous twist of fate, they meet this incredibly colorful character, Charlotte von Malsdorf, who's probably the most famous trans individual in German history. And she, you know, has the story deserving of its own biography. But basically, she runs a museum in the outskirts of East Berlin, and she lets this group use the basement sort of area of this museum for meeting, organizing, and so on. And so they have both a social element. They host cabarets and poetry readings and so on and so forth. But they also have a political element. They start to write petitions to the government. They request to be formally recognized as a sort of organization with state approval. And the state, the East German state, which again, it's a paranoid surveillance dictatorship that has a pretty tight grasp, or tries to have a pretty tight grasp on the sort of social lives of its citizens, it's very resistant to this idea, in part because the way it interprets it is as a special privilege. The state and the Stasi, the secret police functionaries who are reading these petitions and coming up with responses to them, they don't see it as a matter of gay men and lesbians lacking rights that needs to be corrected. They rather see it as these people essentially asking for special privileges. So that effort in the 70s is ultimately unsuccessful in spite of its sort of energy and exuberance. What is really remarkable is in the 80s, activists around East Germany start to organize under the umbrella of the Protestant Church, which is the only sort of nominally independent organization in East Germany. And it's an incredibly decentralized structure. And so individual pastors or whoever can sort of say, yes, come and use my church space to organize, to have parties, to have a poetry reading, whatever. And so the Stasi, the secret police, is completely terrified of this because they already see the church as a sort of oppositional organization. And so they try to prevent these groups from meeting. That's unsuccessful. And eventually they come to the conclusion that their strategy of simply repressing these activist groups isn't working. And they decide to shift strategy. And they decide that the best way to do this is to actually give in to these groups' policy demands. And they sort of have this sort of cynical reasoning that if all of these specific policy issues are addressed, then these activist groups will have no reason to exist, and so they'll simply close up shop. And so between 1985 and 1989, when the Berlin Wall falls, you just have a deluge of pro-gay policymaking. The age of consent is equalized, and this happens about 7 years before it'll happen in the West German states, and you know, over a decade before an equivalent change happens in the US. Gay men are allowed to serve in the military openly for the first time, which again, that's decades before similar changes happen in other, you know, sort of Western states. The regime starts to officially sanction various gay and lesbian sort of social groups. They start to commission movies and books on the topic of homosexuality. So there's just this incredible sort of blossoming of opportunity for gay men and lesbians in East Germany's final years. And that's really sort of one of the most striking findings of the book, that in contrast to West Germany, where the parties and the parliament and the government remain very resistant to these sorts of policy changes, the East German dictatorship ultimately was receptive to them.
And the book does a wonderful job of showing the two trajectories from West Germany and from East Germany. And of course, we all know these are going to collide then mm-hmm. with the unification of Germany in 1989 with the wall coming down. What has that meant for queer culture and for LGBTQ rights in Germany since unification?
So, you know, one thing that historians of modern Germany oftentimes will sort of assume is that when Germany reunified, essentially that process was West Germany annexing East Germany. So East Germany sort of signed on to the West German constitution. And so the assumption for a long time was just sort of, okay, East Germany ceased to exist and sort of nothing was kept from it. And you know, I have an epilogue in the book that sort of thinks about the lingering after effects or echoes of East Germany's gay and lesbian rights movement. And so one of the most concrete examples of this is this law setting an unequal age of consent. So in West Germany, paragraph 175 continues to stay on the books, and it sets a higher age of consent for gay men than for either lesbians or straight couples. And So for several years, you have this very weird situation where in East Germany, there's an equal age of consent, and in West Germany, there's an unequal age of consent, even though they're the same country. And so finally, that gets resolved in 1994, and the parliament finally expunges paragraph 175 from the law books and sets a unified equal age of consent. So that's sort of one of the most easily grasped examples of this. At the same time, there are other progressive changes that are made in East Germany that don't sort of survive. So for instance, the regulation that gay men can serve openly in the military, that in reunified Germany waits until around year 2000 to get changed. The democratically elected East German government in 1990. So in March of 1990, you have free and fair elections that bring a democratic government to power in East Germany. And that's the government that negotiates reunification. That government makes a lot of progressive changes to the law, such as a non-discrimination law. Those are gotten rid of after reunification. So it's sort of this mixed bag of some of this progress does vanish or is sort of subsumed into the more conservative West German state. But there are these echoes. And I think certainly the vibrance of Berlin as one of the world's sort of queer capitals is very much a legacy of its place in the Cold War, both its legacy on the Eastern side as well as on the Western side.
Sort of last question here then, I have my own interest in foreign policy questions. How much is Germany now currently leading the way with respect to LGBTQ rights, you know, both within the mm-hmm. European Union, certainly, and then also globally?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think it's from a foreign policy perspective, I think it is certainly one of the leaders, and that is, you know, something that is very intentionally maintained. I think one really curious thing that many other scholars have also pointed out is that, especially in Western Europe and to some extent in the US, protection of LGBTQ rights has come to be seen as almost a yardstick for democracy or sort of Westernness. And, you know, there's a positive side to this, right? That these rights have gained such acceptance that they're seen as a sort of core or fundamental part of quote unquote Western values. There's also a very negative side to it, that it can be used as a sort of bludgeon with which to denigrate other oftentimes non-Western groups. There's the sort of element of pinkwashing, which you might be familiar with, where politicians will oftentimes use LGBT rights as cover for less savory policies, oftentimes xenophobia or Islamophobia. Donald Trump, for instance, did this in 2016, where he sort of made the case that because he wanted to ban Muslims, he was actually the sort of, you know, gay-friendly candidate. So, you know, there's sort of positive and negative sides to this quite striking evolution in terms of how Western European states think about foreign policy vis-a-vis LGBTQ rights. I will also say that reputation can cover up or obscure the fact that there are still contests over the place of queerness in German society today. So in the academy, for instance, there's been a long struggle to get queer studies or history of sexuality acknowledged as legitimate sort of areas of inquiry. In fact, just this past weekend, for the first time, a memorial was laid at the female concentration camp Ravensbrück to commemorate lesbian victims of Nazism. And it's sort of striking that this is only happening now in 2022. So you do have ongoing struggles to make sure that gay and lesbian and trans victims are remembered, and also that rights continue to be protected and advanced today.
The name of the book is States of Liberation, Gay Men Between Dictatorship and Democracy in Cold War Germany. The author, he's been our guest, Samuel Klose Hunicke, assistant professor of history at George Mason University. He's also the author of Heterogeneous Persecution, Lesbianism, and the Nazi State. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, since the 2020 election, anti-transgender campaigns have been growing. What are these efforts? And in particular, what is this so-called Don't Say Gay bill in Florida? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Across the United States, there have been political campaigns to reverse gay and trans rights, including efforts to ban trans athletes in all levels of competition and bills such as the Florida Don't Say Gay legislation. What do these efforts do? How far are they advancing? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since the 2020 election, conservatives in the United States have directed quite a great deal of political pressure on curtailing and reversing gay and trans rights in the nation. In particular, legislation such as the Florida so-called Don't Say Gay bill have framed the advancement of gay and trans rights as an affront to parental rights in raising children, and even framing the issue of rights protections as sexual exploitation. We will examine this campaign, the legislation passed to support this opposition to equal rights for the gay and trans community, and what it means for legal protections advancing gender equality. Our guest is Clifford Roski. He is professor of law at the University of Utah's S.G. Quinney College of Law. He is the author of Anti-Gay Curriculum Laws, Fear of the Queer Child, and Still Not Equal, a report from the Red States. and also the co-author of an opinion piece, "After 50 Year Stalemate, It's Time to Pass Federal LGBTQ Non-Discrimination Laws." Professor Roski, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, how would you characterize this campaign, this anti-gay, anti-trans campaign that we've been seeing unfolding, you know, over the past few years?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. The first word that comes to mind about this campaign is shocking, because it had been more than 20 years since a state had banned discussion of LGBT people and issues in public schools in our country. It had not happened since sodomy laws were still constitutional and gay people could be thrown in prison just for who they love. And so it's really surprising to see states turn back to this. It really is a trip back to the late 70s and 80s when Anita Bryant first launched the religious rights backlash against the LGBT movement in substance and in tone. As you said, she too was focused on then gay school teachers, but she said that they were recruiting children into, quote, homosexuality. And now we hear anyone who opposes the Don't Say Gay law, the governor of Florida has deemed a groomer, which is just a shorthand for, you know, a pedophile or something like that. So it's really a stunning reversal on behalf of Florida, and now Alabama has followed suit.
One thing that I've noticed is the way in which the issue of gay rights, trans rights, which I think for many people is a question of identity and a question of, you know, a question of personhood, but the opposition has really focused on the sexuality rather than the identity question.
That's a long-standing trend in prejudicial attitudes about LGBT people, that all of the love and the relationship and identity is sort of drained out of LGBT life, and what's what it's replaced with is sex. That is to say, sexual activity. There's a old trope of reducing LGBT people to, or particularly gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, but all to sort of what they do in the bedroom, if you will.
Now, we've heard a lot about this Don't Say Gay bill that has passed in Florida. What exactly does that legislation contain? What exactly are they trying to do with this bill?
So there are two clauses. One says from kindergarten in, I think it's through grade three, it prohibits any discussion of sexual orientation or gender identity at all. And that's in response to questions from students, but certainly in terms of presenting a curriculum. So a good example of that would be there are quite a few children's books that portray same-sex parenthood now, and that would be certainly prohibited by this law. But, you know, even discussing the fact that as a matter of law, a man can marry a man, or a child can have two dads, or a woman can marry a woman, and a child can have two moms, would be prohibited until fourth grade under the law. The second clause says that beyond that, everything has to be age appropriate and developmentally appropriate, which of course no one would quarrel with on its own terms, but it's like an incredibly vague standard. And like the Texas abortion law, the Florida curriculum law allows each individual parent to file lawsuits against individual teachers based on whatever they think is age appropriate or developmentally appropriate. So it automatically it gets reduced to the most conservative possible interpretation of those phrases. So teachers are scared.
Yeah, I can imagine without absolutely clear guidelines that, you know, will protect you from any form of liability, the possibility, the potential that anything you say in the classroom, you would find out. You know, you could end up being in a courtroom. I mean, it could bankrupt.
Even if you hadn't said it, it could bankrupt you, right? Just hiring the lawyer to defend the lawsuit. And this technique of including vague language in a ban in order to chill all speech on the subject is as old as the very first of these laws. In the 70s and 80s, these laws typically prohibited teachers from advocating homosexuality, in quotes, or promoting homosexuality, in quotes. And no one knew what it meant. Back then, simply saying in response to a question, are you gay? Yes, was deemed the advocacy of homosexuality and prohibited by the law. And so people had to stay in the closet, couldn't talk about it at all. And so now we have new vague phrases that are designed to have the exact same effect.
Now, one strategy to expose, you know, this the vague language and the vulnerability, since the language says you cannot advocate for, you know, any questions of sexual orientation, is it possible that if a teacher, if a female teacher were to make reference to her husband, because that would be a sexual orientation question, could they face a lawsuit, or is that, is the language, you know, covers enough to where they have no fear?
So anyone, any parent can file a lawsuit, right? So definitely they could face a lawsuit. And that's what the law says. Now, we know that that's not going to be how it's enforced, right? It's written in that way in a, frankly, pretty futile attempt to shield it from a constitutional challenge. But the idea that you can't say, for example, that President Biden has a wife, because that's discussing his sexual orientation, or that the teacher, you know, has a spouse, or that the teacher is male or female and therefore has a gender identity. Everyone has a gender identity. And so it's if you read it on its face, you would not be able to talk about any relationship or anyone's gender. Whether parents will actually file those lawsuits, I think those issues will probably be raised by LGBT students and teachers who are challenging the law.
There's another trend that I find particularly fascinating, because this has all been framed as a parental rights question. The parents have the rights to raise their children free from, you know, references to gender. But I don't think the Florida law doesn't have this, but I know there have been laws that have been advanced that could potentially prosecute parents who will provide hormone treatments or, you know, other forms of medical treatments for their trans children. I know it's been proposed in Texas. I don't know if it's actually passed. What exactly is behind, you know, those bills, since it definitely seems drawing counter to the notion of parental rights?
Absolutely. And it's quite, perverse, I think, is the right word here, that, you know, scientists, doctors, therapists all agree that one thing that you should never do to an LGBT child is reject their sexual orientation or gender identity and try to change them, because that drives depression, anxiety, and suicide. It's known as conversion therapy or reparative therapy. That ought to be banned in all 50 states. So far, 20 states have passed laws specifically banning it, so that 30 haven't. And these are laws that just would result in, say, a loss of license. Conversely, as you said, now states are starting to ban the gold standard of care for an LGBT child, which is to affirm that child and respect the child's identity. And they've actually criminalized providing life-saving medicine to transgender minors. In Alabama, you can get 10 years for that, the doctor and the parent both, which is just really, it completely contradicts all medical and scientific consensus, and it certainly violates parents' rights. I mean, to throw a parent in prison for 10 years for loving their transgender child and supporting them is itself a kind of crime, I think.
And I don't know, you know, how well you know the actual procedures, but are there trends in these procedures? I know some of them address issues of address hormonal issues in trans children. Is that the extent, or so I guess broadly, what are some of these procedures that trans children typically could undergo?
So the first thing that happens if a child comes out as transgender early in life and they talk to the parents and see a doctor and are diagnosed with gender dysphoria, and that's not essential to this process, but it often happens, is that they socially transition. There's no medical intervention for a prepubescent child. You know, doctors would not do anything. But social transition means live one's life either as a boy or a girl or what have you. And then once puberty begins, this is often a very dangerous time in the life of a transgender child, because the nature of gender dysphoria is they feel, I'm a girl and I'm going through male puberty. It's very upsetting. And so the risk of anxiety, depression, and suicide all spike. And they can give a drug that are colloquially known as puberty blockers. These are drugs that have been used for decades for a small group of children who begin puberty way too early, so they have to delay it. And they've been proven to be safe and effective in simply pressing pause on puberty for those kids, and now being used for transgender kids. And then after a certain period of time, if everyone decides to go forward, the parent in consultation with the doctor and the child, they might begin hormone therapy. So a transgender girl would take estrogen, or a transgender boy would take testosterone supplements. And then, you know, surgery is not until adulthood in most cases.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the anti-LGBTQ campaigns that we're finding in particular in conservative states, you know, conservative initiatives, with Clifford Roski of the University of Utah School of Law. So, Clifford, I know some of the ways that this has manifested itself, you know, so some of these legislations, specifically in schools, have been on issues of bathroom usage, the so-called bathroom bills, as well as bans on sports. So I'll ask you about the first one first, because it's a little bit older. How has the legislation been drawn on these sort of anti-bathroom bills? I mean, how, you know, what does legislation say and how is it enforced?
I mean, what it says is simply that kids must use the bathroom that is consistent with the sex they were assigned at birth. So even if they're able to change their birth certificate and identify as transgender or, you know, a different gender that's on their birth certificate, the original birth certificate, they're not allowed to use that restroom. And we saw the way this all intersects is quite clear. I mean, Alabama is the clearest example. They banned transgender girls from playing on girls' sports teams 1 year. And the very next year, they banned all gender-affirming healthcare for transgender minors, and added a don't say gay law and the bathroom ban all in 1 year. And so it's a pretty wholesale attack that seems certainly more focused on transgender kids than gay kids, and often specifically on transgender girls.
And the way that gets framed as, again, you know, protection. I always think, in particular, male legislators in defending the bathroom bills, it's usually in the form of men will claim to be women so they can become sexual predators in girls' bathrooms. I imagine this has been consistent with the whole notion, again, the sexualization versus gender identity question that has marked this. Yes.
You know, this what this is a repackaging of old stereotypes about gay men from the late 1970s in particular, but even longer than that, first toward transgender women. So the old debate was, oh, if you have a gay teacher, they'll try to, you know, we have to save our children from the recruitment by gay teachers, was Anita Bryant's campaign. And I would say about 10 years ago, the religious right started to realize people just don't think of gay men that way anymore. And so they started saying this about transgender women, as you suggested. There was a big, in Houston, there was a big referendum on a bathroom law. What's really, I mean, that's all very disturbing, right? But what's even more disturbing about this trend is now they're actually demonizing the kids. Right. Back in the 1970s, no one would even accept the notion that a kid could be gay or transgender. That was just a phase. That was a delusion, a mental illness. Now, people recognize that kids can be LGBT, and so they're going after the transgender kids as the threat, so that girls who are not transgender need to be protected from transgender girls in bathrooms and in locker rooms and in showers and places like this.
And also, I know with the trans athletes question, you know, the athletics, again, it's been framed as a protection. We need to protect girls in competitive equality, or, you know, in competitiveness, from these boys who can't win the boys' competitions. And so they become trans so they can win the girls' competition. I mean, I think of Leah Thomas, you know, at Penn State, sort of, you know, being the poster child, you know, of that campaign. But what's interesting is how much that the, in particular, women's athletes have largely embraced trans women competitors. I know at the professional level, the WNBA has been, the athletes have been quite outspoken in embracing trans athletes, and some actually competing in the WNBA. How much does that hold promise that these campaigns, you know, may not be successful if those who are actually doing the competing are saying, we welcome the competition?
I mean, it definitely does seem that the anti-LGBT forces, the opposition to the LGBT movement, they seem to kind of be shifting strategies, trying to find something that will stick and work. You know, bathrooms were all the rage a few years ago, and now sports. And so you definitely see that. I think because sports are sex segregated and were originally sex segregated for the benefit of women and girls to establish equality, this issue is sort of presents in a different way. Quite a few states, including Utah recently, have passed these sports bans. You know, what the right policy is, it's very much in flux. But I think every major sports organization at every level has said, well, a ban is not the answer. The Olympics doesn't have a flat ban. The NCAA does not have a flat ban. But we're seeing these now passed, ironically, at lower levels of sport, where one would think that participation becomes relatively just as important as who wins or something. I mean, Utah's ban applies in middle school. There are no college scouts in middle schools. You know, this is not, it's kind of just inappropriate to even think about this kind of stuff at that level. This one is very much in flux. The Olympics changed its policy recently, and so did the NCAA. And now we have, I think, 15 states have banned transgender girls completely from participating in school sports with other girls.
My last question then is, when I think about the broad issues, LGBTQ issues, whether it's issues of same-sex marriage or, you know, trans identity, trans participation in athletics, et cetera, our students, the Generation Z that's currently in college, it's really striking. Now, I'm in California, you're in Utah, you can reject this this assertion, but so many of them are just aware of, friends with, colleagues of, fellow students who are gay, who are trans, that this sense, this demonization flies in the face of this generation's social circle. So is that the hope that, I mean, obviously these campaigns are succeeding in the short term, but in the medium and the long term, the more and more there's a presence, that there's a gay presence in people's lives, there's a trans presence in people's lives, that the demonization is just not going to be terribly successful? Or am I being kind of Pollyannish and too optimistic?
Well, I mean, I think one can hope for that as a result of struggle, right, and hard work. But it is the work of humanization as opposed to demonization, right? And so I think that's what we see. A powerful but tragic example of this was in Texas, when the Texas governor, he announced that affirming a child as transgender and allowing them to socially transition, hormones, any of that, was child abuse that must be investigated by the Department of Child and Family Services. Well, one of the investigators was the parent of a transgender child. This is actually me you're demonizing. You're asking me to investigate myself. And so moments like that, you know, obviously this person has colleagues. That was part of our process here. Was the Utah legislature had some very misguided notions about transgender kids and athletes and students. And so we, to the extent that it's appropriate, brought in their parents to speak with them. And in some cases, for the older kids who wanted to talk, they came in as well, so they could put a name and a face to this phenomenon. It was estimated that there are 80,000 high school athletes competing in Utah schools, school sports, and four of them are transgender, and only one is a transgender girl. And so you have this statewide ban for, you know, a handful of transgender girls at the most. So it's important for folks to, at some point, encounter people and get to know them so that these stereotypes can fall away.
I think it's a great place to end our conversation, you know, today, and, you know, of course, continuing the conversation. We've been talking about the campaigns against LGBTQ rights, and in particular, campaigns against trans children and gender identity questions like Florida's Don't Say Gay Bill. Our guest today has been Clifford Roski, professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He is the author of Anti-Gay Curriculum Laws, Fear of the Queer Child, Still Not Equal, A Report from the Red States, and the co-author of the opinion article, After a 50-Year Stalemate, It's Time to Pass Federal LGBTQ Non-Discrimination Laws. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.